Now to the book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 54. Isaiah, chapter 54, the very first verse. Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear, break forth into singing and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child, for more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord. Well, in Isaiah chapter 54, the gospel church and its glories are going to be described. Isaiah chapter 53, the previous chapter, is about Calvary. The following chapter, 54, is clearly about the New Testament church. The chapter after that, chapter 55, is about the message of the New Testament church and the preaching, the proclamation of the saving gospel. Here, chapter 54 is without doubt a picture of the church of Jesus Christ. The prophet addresses the remnant. He addresses us today, but he addresses in his own time that faithful minority, the remnant of Israel, of Judah actually, that truly believed and looked forward to the coming one day of the Saviour. Now they've had a hard time, because even the true believers, they've been a minority in a national church, a typical church, where for the most part of their history, the majority were not true believers, were compromisers in some way, had turned aside to idolatry particularly, had disobeyed the Lord. And there were long periods when they were under discipline as a nation. In Egypt, in Assyria, in Babylon. Then later on, of course, under the Persian Empire. And then the Romans, discipline after discipline after discipline. Times of liberty and renewed opportunity, invariably not taken. Some very godly kings to encourage them, prophets nearly all the time, but always they turned away. That was very hard for the believing remnant, for the true believers who had their part in this great typical or national church with whom God had that covenant right through the Old Testament years. Because when the nation as a whole was under discipline, well, the godly remnant had to bear it also for most of the time. So it was difficult for them. And they had that lot. But now, sing, O barren. And the Old Testament church is pictured. And the picture is that of a wife of youth. She has been married to a husband, and she has been an adulterer. She's been disloyal. And so the husband, under the law of ancient times, has put her away. So she is described as desolate, put away, living in shame. Somebody who was a wife of youth, but she was wanton and sinful and disloyal, and so her husband put her at arm's length, and no more did she know his fellowship and his close care. He provided for her, but she was described as desolate. But it's going to be different, because this desolate woman, that's a picture of disobedient Israel, is suddenly going to be a wife again. She's going to be received back by her husband, and she's going to have a great number of children. And this is the prophet's picture of the New Testament church. When Christ would come and he would reveal the method of redemption, and that faithful Jewish minority would be absorbed into the New Testament church of converted Jews and converted Gentiles. And the gospel would go out into the Gentile world, and it would no longer be little Judah, Now she wasn't all that small, but compared with the world, she was still tiny little Judah, but it would be an international family of God's people. Sing, O barren, no children, because at the very beginning of the marriage, she broke the marriage covenant. Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear, break forth into singing, and cry aloud, or cry with joy. It may be that the Hebrew implies that, undoubtedly. Cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child. She was supposed to be a working community in the Old Testament, with all her blessings and her revelation and her prophets, all that she knew. She was supposed to be winning the pagan world. She was supposed to be evangelizing the Gentiles and bringing them in to the kingdom. But in all the centuries that God dealt with her and bore with her, she never did. She never had any children. She never won anybody else. Now, I'm looking at it nationally. I'm sure the faithful few, the minority of true believers, did. But as a nation, she was a failure most of the time. And she hadn't done that. But now, she's got something to sing about, because she's going to be gathered in, and she's going to be a new entity, and she's going to be used. So that's the first verse, and that's the background of the prophecy and the picture that the prophecy begins with. And then we come to verse 2, and I give you a first heading, and it is this, that the church in the New Testament will have a new territory, an altogether new territory. Geographically, she will be entirely different. Verse 2. Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations, the walls of the tent, described as the curtains. Spare not. It's something you're going to have to be involved in and work at. It'll be the Lord's work, but you will have a part in it. So spare not. Don't hold back. Do whatever he commands you. And while you're about it, it's no good just enlarging the tent, but you've got to lengthen the guy ropes to support that tent. And there are going to be ferocious winds and gales of hostility hurled against that tent. Make sure they're strong guys and they're long enough. And strengthen thy stakes, the tent pegs. So the church of the New Testament is pictured as a tent. And a tent is a mobile thing. And a temporary thing. It's almost as though even in the illustrations of the prophecy, God is saying, in the New Testament church, we don't make deep roots in this world. We don't settle here. We don't live for the here and now. Of course, we have to. In a measure, we have to get homes, we have to look after our families, but don't be settled and focused on and concentrating on here. You're pictured as a tent. You're on a journey to the eternal glory, and you're like a military body camping, and you've got a task to do and a mission to pursue. So the tent illustrates the church at the beginning of the prophecy. And in a practical manner, you can make a number of things of the components of the tents. The cords. They're the doctrines that hold us. The doctrine of the work of Christ and his all-sufficient sacrificial death on Calvary's cross. These are the great guys that hold up the tent no matter what is hurled against it. And the stakes, maybe you might say, they're the officers of the church. Make sure you have officers who will stand for the truth, who will spot the declines, the things that come along that will weaken and in time destroy the church and ruin its witness. They're not flabby people theologically and spiritually, but they love the gospel and cherish it, and they won't have it not preached, or things that ruin it. They won't let the world gate crash the church and dilute its power and spoil it. Strengthen thy stakes. There's something for us to do. There's a new territory. This tent is going to be worldwide. Verse 3, for thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left. As the language is illustrative. Of course, we would say to the north and to the south and to the east and to the west. This has a geographical application. The family of God's people will be found everywhere in New Testament times. It'll be a missionary church. It will reach out constantly. And thy seed, your children, shall inherit the Gentiles. There it is now emerging from the language of illustration and using plain terms, mass Gentile conversion. Back into the language of pictures and make the desolate cities to be inhabited and places that were spiritually completely desolate will have churches and a witness and the preaching of the gospel all over the world. Thou shalt break forth. That's why we're always concerned about outreach. Of course, we're concerned as a church and must be about the care of souls in our church family and about our own progress and spirituality and loyalty to the Lord. But that's only part of our work. We're also always a missionary church, concerned about outreach, concerned about lost souls, and there has to be missionary zeal. And if the internet opens up as it has, we want to be represented. If different means make themselves available, we've got to use them if they're legitimate and proper and can be handled in a godly manner, because we're a missionary church. And here in verse 3, it can't be confined to the Holy Land and Jerusalem any longer. It's worldwide. And then down here in verse 4, fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame. You'll not be let down. You'll never find that the proclamation of the gospel doesn't work. For thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth. The Old Testament church will be past and gone. Failure to reach out. Failure to represent the Lord. Instead of winning the pagan world, they conformed themselves to the pagan world. And they were desperate to imitate it in every way. In having a king, first of all. In following their gods and their worship and their conduct and their delights and everything they did. They were so anxious to be like the world. Can't you see history being repeated in our day? When the church, far from winning the world, is constantly and increasingly conforming itself to the world. But if you're true to the Lord, you'll forget the shame of thy youth. When that Old Testament church had for long periods to be put away by the Lord, and they did not enjoy his communion and his power. And the ultimate demonstration of that was the nearly four centuries long intertestamental period before the coming of Christ, when no prophet spoke the inspired word, and they saw no signs and the evidences of the presence and power of God were withdrawn. But thou, the New Testament church, shalt forget the shame and the abandonment by God of the youth of the typical church, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood, God withdrawing any more. And then in verse 5, a new relationship. Very quickly, a second heading. Not only a new territory, but a new relationship. For thy maker is thine husband. He's had you back. He's brought you back in the shape of the church. Look at the number of titles there are of God in verse 5. You could call this the 5 points of the Godhead towards the church. He's your husband. He's caring for you again. He's your husband. He cares for you. He's the Lord of hosts. That speaks of his power to care for you. He's the Lord of hosts of angels. One single word from God commands the hosts of heaven to the aid of his people. And thy Redeemer, your purchaser, the one who's bought you with his own blood and purchased you to be his own property. The God of the whole earth. Well, I should have said the Holy One of Israel. We never forget that title because he's holy. And we must strive to be holy. And we can't serve him with impure hearts and soiled hands. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. He is the God of the Gentiles too, as well as the Jews. So our burden and our mission is souls everywhere. And then back to his illustration in verse 6. This is a new relationship. For the Lord hath called thee as a woman, forsaken and grieved in spirit, put away for your adultery. As a wife of youth, when thou wast refused, thrust away, saith thy God. That's your past. But verse 7, for a small moment. It's a small moment by comparison with what God will do. It seems to us to have been centuries. The centuries of the Old Testament of disobedience and disciplines. But it's a small moment. There's a great contrast here when compared with the time that God will have mercy throughout time and eternity. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, put thee away from your station. But with great mercies, it's all by grace, will I gather thee. Somebody translates it, and it's good, embrace thee. Another contrast, verse 8, it's a new relationship. In a little wrath, my anger was small by comparison with my love. In a little wrath, I hid my face from thee for a moment. But with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord, thy Redeemer. What contrasts the inspired prophet gives us. And then he comes to details of this relationship in verse 9. For this is as the waters of Noah unto me. For as I have sworn that the waters of Noah shall no more go over the earth, there'll never be another universal flood. In all the history of time, never another. So, there will never be another discipline of the kind the Jews of old had to know for the Church of God. There will never be a Babylon. There will never be a Persian Empire ruling us. There will never be a Roman Empire ruling us. It will never happen again. That was the era of discipline after discipline. But we won't rebel. This is the true church. We will stand by Christ and the gospel. We love him, we found him. We may backslide, but in his mercy, he'll bring us back, even if it takes a small discipline. There won't be a mass scale rejection of true Christian people anymore. Verse 10. For the mountains shall depart, and they will one day, and the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from thee, neither shall the covenant of my peace. This is a far better covenant than the nation of Israel had as a nation. This is the covenant of grace, which will never be broken, because it's not between God and man. Man would break it. It's between God the Father and God the Son, and it can never be broken. And Christ takes our part for us and offers up his perfect sacrifice and obedience and works. And in verse 11, we come just, and I must speed on, to a third heading, and again quickly, it will be a new composition. The church is made up of a different kind of person. It has a different composition. Verse 11 begins this little section. O thou afflicted, they were then, tossed with tempest and not comforted. When is Messiah coming? Behold, this is what I'm going to do, and your whole composition will be different. I will lay thy stones with fair colours. What are you doing, Isaiah? What are you doing to us with these amazing twists and turns of language? A few verses ago, I was a tent. Now I'm some kind of a palace or a temple. The imagery is suddenly changed, and it, as it were, takes my breath away. It's typical of Isaiah and his style that God used and inspired. Yes, we're a tent. We have no firm dwelling place here. We're apparently fragile, and storms come against us. But looked at another way, we will equally be seen as a palace, and no ordinary palace, because these stones are not of limestone or granite. These stones are massive gems, precious stones. The walls are huge, solid, precious stones. An astonishing picture. Behold, I will lay thy stones. What are the stones? They're the lively stones, the living stones of 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. The living stones of the church of Jesus Christ. I will lay thy stones with fair colours. Our translators have translated a little three-character word in the Hebrew, which is slightly obscure, as fair colours. But this little word in the Hebrew, just three simple characters, is in literature a word used for eye makeup or mascara, though it's a different substance in Old Testament times. Who would erect a building using mascara as mortar? That would be the most incredibly expensive and extravagant thing imaginable. Forget the fact it isn't even very sticky. That's beside the point. The point is Such is the extravagance of God in the use of the most precious building materials to construct his New Testament church, because every stone and even the mortar employed to attach them one to another, every stone is fashioned by the hand of God. This is a regenerate church. These are born again people. These are people who've been illuminated and given a new nature and a new life. So extravagant language is called for. The tent becomes a building of precious stones. I will lay thy stones with fair colours or antimony or mascara, and lay thy foundations with sapphires. The foundation is always the work of Christ. The most precious sapphires undergird our faith. And I will make thy windows, have a modern version, they prefer to translate it battlements, which is probably correct, windows or battlements of agates, rubies, thought to be today a better word to use. Even the battlements that top the building catch the sun with fantastic colour. This is a place of outstanding beauty. And thy gates, also of carbuncles or very precious stones. All the doctrines and the work of Christ. And of course the people. The church is a thing of beauty. It's now a place of beauty and character and zeal and sincerity and unselfishness. Beautiful things in the church of Jesus Christ. Let us hope so. And all thy borders, the walls and buildings around the main structure, all the verges, all of something, the suburbs of pleasant stones. As you approach the Church of Christ, you come across Christians proclaiming, different people, people of great sincerity and character, who commend the church. Verse 13, this is still about a new relationship. And all thy children shall be taught of the Lord. Now our dear Presbyterian friends believe that if you're baptized as a little child, you may be regarded as a covenant child. As a little child, you may grow up with an awful temper or a great many things wrong with you. And you may exhibit, like all of us as children so often do, every kind of sinful traits and behaviour. And if you ask a dear Presbyterian church, what about this child and his status before the Lord? He'll say, well, he isn't saved yet. Well, then is he a covenant child? Oh, yes. But he's a covenant child, but he isn't saved. Well, they've got all kinds of definitions. Click in here. You see, he's a legal member of the covenant rather than a living member of the covenant. Well, Isaiah had never heard of these distinctions. He's very straightforward. All thy children shall be taught of the Lord. If you're in the family of God, you're saved. If you're not saved, you're not yet in the family of God. You're not a covenant anything. Oh, but what about Abraham? Wasn't the covenant made with Abraham and his children? No, says Isaiah in effect, which is exactly echoed by the Apostle Paul, particularly in Galatians. The covenant was made with Abraham and his spiritual seed. People who had faith like him, his spiritual children, not all his literal children. So in that respect, we don't agree with our Presbyterian friends to try to squeeze the children in by various means. We're much more straightforward, as we believe the scripture is. Membership of the Church of Christ is for those who are his. And all thy children to regenerate membership shall be taught of the Lord, illuminated by the Spirit, and great shall be the peace of thy children, which actually is a way of saying they will have the marks of conversion in them, that they are reconciled with the living God. And until they do, we plead with them and pray for them and witness to them. In righteousness shalt thou be established, thou shalt be far from oppression, for thou shalt not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near thee. Now this introduces us, and I must work to conclusion now quickly, this introduces us to our final fourth heading, a new victory. In righteousness, in the righteousness of Christ, shalt thou be firmly set, established. Thou shalt be far from oppression. What does Isaiah mean? We do know oppression. We do know persecution, opposition, hostility, the powers of unbelief. You must understand, dear friends, Isaiah is speaking spiritually. We shall know oppression. What right do I have to interpret the passage? Well, as we shall see, Isaiah goes on to explain it himself. They will surely come against you, he says in so many words. But it will never actually deflect your purpose. It will not take you from your objective. It need not scare you. It will not take you away from God. It will not take your spiritual fruit and spoil your mission. The oppression will be there. In Old Testament days, you too would be carried off to Egypt, even if you were a member of the believing minority within Israel. You too would be carried off to Babylon, whatever the discipline oppression was. But in New Testament days, they will oppress you, but they cannot do anything to hinder or remove your spiritual good and your blessing and your eternal reward. In righteousness thou shalt be established, thou shalt be far from oppression, for thou shalt not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near thee. It's a spiritual view. Take the Apostle Paul. Everyone knows this. They put him in prison. And more than once. Did it spoil his work? No, it only changed it. He became a powerful witness in prison. He had converts in Caesar's household because he was in Caesar's prison. He was mightily used of God. On the way to prison, and while in prison, he witnessed to kings. He wrote his prison epistles, a major part of the New Testament, that will last until Christ comes, part of the inspired word. His being in prison so challenged churches in Rome and other places that suddenly they got down to witness. The apostle will go to prison for the faith, and so should we, if necessary. And it electrified believers. Some people have tried to make the case, and that they almost can, that the apostle was more fruitful in prison than out of it. Because the word of God is always true, thou shalt be far from oppression, for thou shalt not fear. And it's like this to the end of the book, verse 15, behold, they shall surely gather together, but not by me. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall for thy sake. Beautiful piece of reasoning. Christians never fear. If people make weapons to attack you, don't forget, it's God who made the iron from which the weapons are made. It's God who made the technology which they employ to manufacture their weapons. It's God who made the manufacture of the weapon. This doesn't mean he's behind it, but it indicates his power. It's God who made the person who's attacking you. Don't you think if he's done all that, he can curb them or deflect them or cause their hostility to rebound upon themselves if he chooses? Of course he can. That's the reasoning of the verse. No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord. It's wonderful, dear friends. A new territory, the whole world. A new relationship, the new birth and membership of the family. A new composition for the church, wholly composed of regenerate people, so far as we can ensure. And a new victory. We're invincible. Professor Dawkins can do absolutely nothing to hinder or stop the conversion of a single elect soul. He is powerless. Isaiah has it all. The glory of the New Testament church.